friends, distinguished elected officials, and panelists. I'm Joan Creste, Vice President for External Affairs here at St. Joseph's University. Recently, a very famous person said if I had a son, he would look like Trayvon Martin. I do have a son, and he does look like Trayvon. In fact, I have two sons that look like Trayvon. This is a critical topic, and we at St. Joseph's University are very happy to support a dialogue on the issue of race and social justice. In fact, peace and social justice are a core of our Jesuit mission here at St. Joseph's. Each year, we work to increase the college readiness and college success for African American students through our Ignatian College Connection program run by Valerie Dudley, sitting in the back. This month, we celebrated the 50th anniversary of our Faith Justice Institute, and we look forward to welcoming a founder of that institute this July with our new president, Father Kevin Gillespie. And last month, we announced a new name for our former Institute for Violence, Anti-Violence Research and Prevention, now the Richard Johnson Center, headed by Maria Kafalas on the panel tonight. Many of you know that Richard Johnson was an African-American St. Joseph's student who was murdered before he could step foot on this campus for freshman orientation. Regardless of the outcome of this case, the issues of justice, particularly for African-American males, remain critical in this society. I thank Senator Hardy Williams for his leadership on this matter of importance to all of us, and want to recognize also the Honorable Louise Bishop, who joined us this evening. Thank you all.
Good evening.
Good evening.
My name is Lana Adams. I'm the co-founder of Mic Check 1-2 and part of the organizing team of this event tonight. First, I really just want to thank everyone for coming out. I want to thank Senator Williams for helping us organize this and get this together. I also want to thank Nathan Wilson. This was his idea to do this discussion, and we all just banded together and made it happen. We think it's very important that we don't just do the marches and the protests and the rallies because, you know, after a while, that kind of fizzles away, and then who's Trayvon? Who's, you know, who are these people? Who was Troy Davis? We don't really know after a while. So we think it's important to have this discussion and continue to have this discussion about what the Philadelphia community can do about race relations in America and injustice. And I think if we educate ourselves, that would make a lot of difference. So, again, thank you all for coming out. Thank you, State Representative Louise Bishop, for coming out. Thank you to our panelists, and thank you guys for coming out. With no further ado, I'm going to introduce Nathan Wilson, and we're going to get started.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen.
Good evening.
My name is Nathan Wilson, and I'm part of the organizing team. Nathan Wilson of thecolorcurve.com, and I'm proud to be with you this evening to discuss a story that's become a hot-button topic around the United States and also across the world. Not too long ago, I came up with the idea to not have a rally, not to have a protest, not to have a march, but to have an intellectual discussion about what the Philadelphia community can do about violence, about injustice, and about race relations in America. What does this Trayvon Martin story mean to our community? Well, thanks to my very good friends Lana Adams and also St. Joseph's University student Elliot Paulson, who couldn't be here tonight, we got the ball rolling and began to make some phone calls. And I was very, very pleased and very impressed with the fact that people were calling me back and were also very excited to talk about this particular issue. I want to offer a very special thank you to Senator Anthony Williams. Can you please give him a hand for helping us put this together? Thank you for making this a reality, Senator Williams. I also want to thank the exceptional institution that is St. Joseph's University. I want to thank you for the resources that you've offered us. I also want to thank you for the space, the administrators, and the professors that will speak for this panel and for allowing us to make this happen here. At this particular time, I want to introduce the moderator for this evening. She is one of the main reasons why I am here today. Years ago, it was in the radio booth that I had the opportunity to sit with her and to speak with her and to experience something that I knew was going to be part of my life for many years to come. She is my inspiration to serve my community here in the Philadelphia area, and my exposure to her and the Clear Channel offices allowed me to sit with individuals like Jerry Mondesai of the NAACP, to speak with Jesse Jackson, and to speak with Shaka Fatah. And I'm very, very pleased to have her here with us this evening. She's a major influence on me, and I'm honored to have her on this panel. Ladies and gentlemen, can you please offer a round of applause for Lorraine Ballard-Morrow.
You know, I think there's nothing more satisfying and gratifying in life than to meet a young man like Nathan and to see what a fine young man he is growing into. And I'm so proud of you, so thank you. It's great to be here, and it's also sad to be here in a way that we're having this discussion. It's also exciting because it's a conversation that we have between us in the community, and yet now it's becoming a global conversation. And that's what we're going to be doing here today, not just talking about Trayvon, but really what the impact of this conversation is for the future of social policy, of political policy, criminal justice, because Trayvon is more than just a young man who is killed, perhaps assassinated, but he's really a symbol of so much more. And with that, I'd like to introduce our esteemed panel, and we begin with State Senator Anthony Hardy Williams, who is a Democratic whip and has served as Democratic caucus chair. He now assumes the second highest ranking position in caucus leadership. He succeeds Senator Michael Opaque, who died in December of last year. Senator Anthony Hardy Williams has been long engaged in our community in so many different ways, certainly has done so much to uplift young people. Next we have with us Joylynn Mackey. Joylynn Mackey is founder of Remote Breakthrough Seminars and an adjunct professor at Eastern University. She's the author of the book Growing Into Your Purpose, Becoming the New You. Also, we have with us Kurt Wilkerson, who is the Constituent Services Representative for Councilman Clark's 5th District Office, overseeing the development and upkeep of all recreation centers located in the district, and has been at the table to assist in the decisions of capital projects. We have with us as well Kevin Harding Jr., an Assistant District Attorney in the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office, currently assigned to the office's Juvenile Division. He is a 2010 graduate of Temple University's Beasley School of Law, where he was a member of the Temple Moot Court Honor Society, the Vice President of the Black Law Students Association. We have representing St. Joe's, Maria Kefalis, Professor of Sociology at St. Joe's, an author of 3 books. She has lectured widely about the challenges facing poor families, youth, and rural America. Her work has been featured in newspapers including the New York Times and the Washington Post, the Inquirer, and many others. She is has been interviewed on NPR and has been on the Tavis Smiley Show. Her newest project explores the impact of the Great Recession on the millennial generation. Last but not least, one of my very favorite people in the whole wide world, State Representative Louise Bishop, who is not only a very wonderful representative for her district, but a fantastic radio personality, a true role model for me, has one of the most gorgeous voices, I think, in radio, and continues to fight the good fight out in our community. So I'd like to also acknowledge a couple of folks. A couple of folks who are representing government as well. Tiffany Wilson is Director of Constituent Activities for the Office of State Senator Vincent Hughes, and representing the mayor is my very good friend Erica Atwood, Hello. Okay. And I'd like to acknowledge all of you for being here today. It's a Saturday night. It's kind of a dreary night, and yet you're here. And I'm really amazed and proud that so many of you have chosen to come be a part of this very important conversation. So let's begin this conversation by allowing each of our panel members to briefly talk a little bit about how they feel that the Trayvon Martin. And I have something else I have to add. Oh my gosh. How could I? Oh my heavens. Kenyatta Johnson. Sorry. It's obviously the hood, right? How could I forget my very good friend, Kenyatta Johnson, who formerly was a state representative and is now a proud and progressive city council member. And he is someone who's also very engaged in the community, particularly in the Peace Not Guns campaign that he is engaged in. And I apologize for, I don't know how that happened, but certainly Kenyatta Johnson is a true warrior out there and a true public servant. So let's begin with State Senator Anthony Hardy Williams. And let's talk a little bit, if you could briefly reflect on how this conversation about Trayvon Martin is impacting our conversation about the treatment of African-American men.
That's a large...
I know.
That's a large question. Let me start with the most obvious. The next generation that we continuously talk about is now arrived. And I want to thank the heads of colorcurve.com and MikeCheck12. You all are really outstanding current generation people. I want to tip my hat to you and your efforts to put together something like this in a thoughtful way. I really do. And to all of you who decide to come out tonight to spend your weekend doing things that will not be reported in Channel 6, Channel 3, Channel 10, or written on the Inquirer Daily News, we do, and I am encouraged to see we do have a reflective, thoughtful generation that is taking hold in not only Philadelphia, but in this country. And I've witnessed that as we've proceeded through this conversation about this murder which occurred. And I think what has impacted me the most is not how could this happen, because unfortunately, myself and others, regardless of your station in life, and I actually have a title, I'm formally educated, have a degree in economics, know I am just a Friday night being in a different state in a different city from police officer coming up against my car and possibly deciding that I've moved too quickly, not presenting my identification quickly enough, where I look like I'm inebriated or on drugs. That doesn't shock me. It doesn't shock me that a police officer could actually make up a story such as the ones that they created and fabricated on Trayvon Martin. It doesn't shock me that even a citizen, overzealot, could end up tragically murdering someone. I guess what does shock me is it's taken so long for them to prosecute this young man. That this person is still not arrested in this country. We're going to talk about a variety of things, race relations, have a perspective, talk about public service, talk about the media, talk about everything. But I want us not to focus, and I've read the most recent articles about should we focus more upon those who march for the ones who are slaughtered in our streets and everywhere. We can do all that, but I don't want to lose focus on the one thing. Zimmerman is still not arrested today. He is not arrested today. The most underlying significant thing is that means the justice system in this country is broken. And it's not just broken for black people. When this happens, it happens for a nation. The civil rights movement, which wraps its arm around frequently Dr. King, and people will talk about African Americans. The truth is, if you're a disabled person, if you're a woman, if you're a veteran, I can go down the list of people who have benefited by the civil rights movement. The same exists today. There are people in all parts of this country, be they Latino, Asian, women, poor, who are traumatized by law enforcement within their communities. And I'm sure there's been somebody who's been murdered within those communities. What we should be most concerned about is that not it's 2012 or 2013, I don't care what year it is, this man should be arrested today. There are enough facts, regardless of whether he's found guilty or not of any crime, there are enough facts for him to be arrested. And what is most troubling, certainly as a black man, but any citizen, is that justice is supposed to be colorblind, but obviously it's color-coded in this conversation. And that doesn't serve us, any of us, if we want to have safe communities. And so for me, I start with the most. I hope that we will gain insight about what to do, how we can have an imprint, and embolden ourselves as a community better heard and better understood. But I hope we will also have a strategy and some thoughtfulness about how we make sure that this man, within the next week, is arrested and charged with a significant crime, and hopefully, in my opinion, of course, will be prosecuted for the fullest extent of the law. That's the least of this conversation. But that's where I think I start. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Joylynn Mackey, your comment.
I concur. I think that this crime that happened was not just a crime against the black community. This is a crime against all of humanity. And I think that one of the keys for us is to make sure that we understand that perspective and how large this particular incident is. I also think that one of the things that we must do, as Senator Williams spoke about in the sense of strategy, not only strategy for this particular case, but this is something that we have seen since 1865. Mm-hmm. And so we need a strategy going forward for how we can create change that is going to be effective for everyone that lives in this country. And so I think that's what I'm looking forward to tonight as we engage as well, to talk about large-scale change.
Okay. City Councilman Kenyatta Johnson, actually I think you have a very unique perspective because you have come from a background that you understand what the streets are all about. And you have transcended that, and you've risen up, and you are now a public servant. And I wonder, you know, based on your own experiences and in your past and your current position in politics, I wonder if you can comment on what we're talking about here.
Yes. Good evening, everyone. Well, first and foremost, I'd like to thank Senator Williams. I'd like to thank St. George University. I'd like to thank Nathan Wilson and ColorCurve.com, as well as the Mic Check organization for organizing this very important and much needed event. Dr. King once said, "No man is an island of himself. For what impacts one directly impacts all indirectly, because we're all a part of mankind." And when I received an email, I actually come out to participate in this panel, I reflected upon two particular things that I'm dealing with. One, the issue of black-on-black violence that I'm dealing with on a regular basis, but two, the issue of race relations in the city of Philadelphia, as well as in America. And I thought about how I transformed myself from being a young man who naturally wear hoodies, who naturally go to the corner store, who naturally still talk to my friends whom I've grown up with, and how sometimes I'm living in two separate worlds. I've had experiences being pulled over in my regular car, in my regular clothes, only for an officer to say, to recognize me and say, "That's Representative Johnson." And to be quite frank with you, once they recognize me, They would come up with some type of bogus reasons as to why I was pulled over and would let me go. Trayvon Martins are all throughout the city of Philadelphia as well as the United States as a whole. This brought me back to a time when four young men who were pursued by the Philadelphia Police Department, they were accused of doing some things, and rather or not they did it or not, they were basically filmed being beat down in the streets of North Philadelphia. It brought me back to how in the city of Philadelphia, the city recently just lost a lawsuit regarding the issue of racial profiling. And so Trayvon Martin kind of put in context the issue of race relations as a whole in the city. But more importantly for me, it really began to clarify the direction that we need to go in as it relates to policy and justice for particularly African-American young men. Staying your ground law does not give you the right to take a person's life, regardless of what the incident may be. This is an injustice. It's a tragedy. And I echo what the senator just said. Justice has to be done. But as we talk more, I want to get into a broader context of also how do we address this issue locally on a day-to-day basis. So thank you very much.
Okay. Curtis Wilkerson, your turn.
Thank you, everyone. I just want to say good evening, and hopefully we'll come out of this discussion with something that's very substantive, and we can make some change in the city and the nation as a whole. I just want to, like, sort of put something to it. The question is there justice in the wild? George Zimmerman was the predator. Trayvon Martin was the prey. He was on the hunt. This is something that was going to happen regardless. Whether it was Trayvon Martin or someone else, he was due to find someone and do some justice. He's a vigilante. They're just point blank, period. It's murder that he committed. And it's a shame that it took this long that he still hasn't been arrested. And that needs to be brought up. Why is it taking so long? There's just too much injustice that's going on in this country. I think that we have some leaders that can step up to the plate and make some things happen.
Okay. Kevin Hardin Jr., you are in a unique position because you are on the side of the district attorney's office. I wonder if you can bring your own perspective from that side of it to this whole conversation.
No problem. One thing I will... I'm going to, of course, go to my boy Kenyatta, because me and Kenyatta have very similar backgrounds. People that are close to me know that there was a big newspaper article because I'm probably the first.
I'm going to get closer to the mic, or that mic isn't working.
I'm probably the first district attorney that was, on the record drug dealer who grew up in West Philly and did all that stuff, got shot 5 times. So I play it in both roles. I'm a law enforcement official who's allegedly broke the law before. I'm not too crazy about the Trayvon Martin case. Number one, because I'm on the ground. I'm currently assigned to something called B Court. B Court is in the family court building, and it's pretty much any time a crime occurs between an adult and a kid. So if an adult shoots a kid, or if an adult does something to a child that is illegal, I'm on the case. So I see cases where young men are shot by children every day. Children are shot by grown-ups every day. That's my job. And I work with Philadelphia police officers every day. And I know what it's like to be the antagonist when it comes to the Philadelphia police officers. And I know what it's like to be a supporter for Philadelphia police officers. The first thing is that, when the Trayvon case came down, of course I had no time to look at it because in Philadelphia we have a serious crime issue. But since I sat on this panel, I said, let me do what I need to do, sit down, do my research, and figure out what exactly is going wrong with this case. Because something went wrong. Investigations don't take a day, and the 911 tapes, I listen to them, and they're tragic. He was a vigilante. Zimmerman was a vigilante. It's easy. But There are people in the Sanford Police Department chief resigned for a reason. We don't know that reason yet, but somewhere along that line, he made a call. He made a decision that pretty much made reverberations around the world. But I want everybody to just think about this rationally. And that's really the reason why I feel that this is what can come from this panel. Zimmerman went into that police station in handcuffs that night. Anybody that watched that video, he went into that police station in handcuffs. They took him in as a criminal. I would never want to be the person to make the decision as to whether or not we arrest George Zimmerman. And I'm going to tell you why. O.J. Simpson was guilty of murder. People pretty much know that. But because of his star status,
you're opening up a whole can of worms there, okay? You understand that.
This is an example. I'm going to tell you what happens when these types of things happen. My law professor used to say, she worked in California as a district attorney. She's the dean of Temple Law School. She said, they framed a guilty man, and it created reasonable doubt. The bad thing about this whole thing is the stand your ground law. The stand your ground law gives people the opportunity to call an attorney and say, you know, what story do I tell that makes it okay for me to shoot a young black man in Sanford, Florida? Because anyone who's the son of a judge can get on the phone and call someone and call their attorney, because you have the right to an attorney. And I did a lot of research before I came up here. He's the son of a judge. And come up with a story that would allow you to justify what happened. Surprisingly, most people don't realize this. Let's say a murder happens in Philadelphia, and 25 people tell the police who did it, but nobody will sign a statement or say that they're coming to court saying that they saw the murder. The police won't arrest that murderer because they don't have any evidence. I'm really, really saddened by Trayvon Martin's murder. I call it a murder because, I mean, the evidence points that way. But, you know, before you go throwing handcuffs on people, you have to have a certain burden that you have to get to. And I think that we have the tools in which we can prosecute Zimmerman, but we have to let the tools of justice work, because there are a lot. It's not going to be a case where you're going to get an eyewitness up there that's going to get up there and say, yes, I saw him shoot him over this. It's going to be a he say, she say game. And when you have that type of case as a prosecutor, it's very, very difficult to just throw handcuffs on people and try to prosecute a case when you don't have enough evidence. Now, the media spin that's going to happen over the next 6 months is going to make this an even harder case to win. But what I think that we should take from this is that there is power that we have demonstrated as a people, institutional power. And the best thing I always say about Philadelphia is that everybody that runs law enforcement in Philadelphia is African-American. We've got a black district attorney. We've got a black U.S. attorney. We've got a black federal defender. The three chief judges in the federal court are black, because the Third Circuit chief court judge, Judge McKee, black. Judge Joyner, black. Judge Wells, black. The chief judge of the administrative court in criminal justice side, Sheila Wood Skipper, black. The chief federal defender, Lay Skipper, black. So we don't have these problems in Philly because we've had institutional accountability, because we got tired of this a long time ago. In Sanford, Florida, they may have one murder a year. So we have to make sure that the rest of the country recognizes that these things are unacceptable, and that when this happens in those little towns where you don't have this sort of crime and you allow these vigilantes to go forward, when you have laws like the Stand Your Ground law, which are passed for all of Florida, but it also applies to little places like Sanford. I bet a Stand Your Ground law won't get passed in Pennsylvania.
I thought we had it.
No, we have the Castle Doctrine, and I'll explain the difference when we get a chance. But
yeah, well, we'll get back to that, because I think that bears having a further discussion. But let's move on to Dr. Maria Kafalas. And you are an expert on the millennial generation, and I want to ask you just a little bit of a curve question in the sense that I wonder whether the fact that we are in this we have this generation, this millennial generation, that's been so active in bringing forward the Jayvon Martin case. I wonder if you feel there's a generational shift that has allowed this conversation to explode in the way that it has exploded.
Oh, I had two distinct reactions to the Trayvon Martin case. And one, and I cried. And I didn't cry for the reason you might think I cried. I cried because I wasn't surprised that it happened. And I was surprised how numb I was in this situation, saying to myself, of course. And I am also, I see the problem, if there's a problem and a lesson here for Pennsylvania, it is the stand your ground law, which is being, it is not on the books here, but there are strong proponents for it here. And it would be very disturbing to see that law. Oh, but we have the Castle Doctrine, which is just, which is a variation on a theme, but this is a much more aggressive, a much more dangerous law. What I found so amazing, when I talk to my students, one of the things I ask them as we discuss the impact of social media, I always say, what would Dr. Martin Luther King been able to accomplish with social media? And the thing that has come out of this, as I was, as an expert, as someone who looks at this, who works with police officers and works with families who've lost their children, who knows a statistic which I think everyone who hears me speak probably must be sick of hearing, but I feel like I must spread the statistic that here in neighborhoods in Philadelphia, where our young black men live in large numbers and in great levels of poverty, that for young black men in Philadelphia, you have a greater chance of meeting a violent death than a soldier on active duty in Iraq.
Mm.
This was published in an obscure journal that no one ever read, but I feel like I need to bring out that point. And so in a context when there's a war and life is cheap, these things happen. And the lives of black men in our society are so cheap and thrown away with such ease that's why I wasn't surprised that Trayvon happened. But what has given me such great hope was that the picture of the Miami Heat and the symbol that the hoodie has taken on, and the fact that thousands of young people who did not know each other, who had not organized, who had no formal group, were taking to the streets wearing hoodies and having an amazing conversation. And so I think that there is so much power in this generation, in this case. Whether there is justice for Trayvon Martin, I am less sure of that. Whether they'll be able to prosecute George Zimmerman simply because of the reality of the law. But I am so much more hopeful that the circumstances of his death will do so much more than punish George Zimmerman. I think it's going to start a different conversation and empower young people in this country in a way that we've never seen. And maybe they will start taking on incarceration, violence, and so many other issues.
Thank you. Reverend Lewis, you've been the witness to tremendous changes over the last several decades regarding civil rights and social justice. And I wonder, using your perspective over time, how do you see the Trayvon Martin case?
Thank you very much, Lorraine. First of all, let me say, though you have been welcome to St. Joe's University, let me say to all of you, welcome to the 192nd Legislative District, where, of course, I am the representative. And I want to congratulate those who have put forth effort to bring together this group tonight. As I sat and sort of looked out over the audience, I couldn't help but reflect. I'm probably the most senior in the audience. And I can reflect on the days when Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and Malcolm X and Stokely Carmichael and all of those who had visions of uniting African American people because of the injustices that were taking place not just in one area, but around the nation, across the nation. And I thought about how brave it is that you young people at this time have come to this point where you're standing up and saying, what has taken place with Trayvon is unfair, and we want to see justice done. It's often said that history is a series of events that repeats themselves. And while it did not perhaps appear that this was going to happen, I think that we had fallen into a state of complacency. And we have taken a lot of things for granted and thought that whatever was wrong is going to work out. Nothing can happen to it. And I believe Trayvon's murder is going to awaken not only Florida, but it's going to awaken this nation to where we rise up again and unite again and say this will never happen, not only to an African-American boy, but it won't happen to a Hispanic or any other boy. That if injustice is done, those who did it are going to be punished. So I believe that we are on a new wave of looking at what is happening in this country. The injustice is just not in Trayvon's murder, but the injustice in where we live, how we're treated, how we're the last to get hired and the first one to be fired. All of these things have led to the murder where someone feels that they can just shoot someone and get away with it. So it is making a statement today in this time, 2012, that this is going to be a different time, that we have a different generation of people, and that they are not going to stand by and see it. Even though some of us who've gotten old and complacent and fought the fight before, who think it's over, and yet you hear, whenever you politically listen, people saying every day, we're taking our country back. That means there's already an effort being made to put us back. And so it's time, overtime, overdue. Congratulations to all of you for organizing, for putting this together, for having the media, and for having the world look at Philadelphia to say, we're not going to take this. Something has got to be done. Thank you.
Reverend Louise, she still has got the fire in her belly. All right, I just want to recognize the fact that we are going to have a conversation, that this will be interactive, and that we encourage you to be a part of the conversation. We'll have our panel talk a little bit more, but I want you to start thinking about ideas, solutions, experiences, what you're planning to do. The fact that you're here is a concrete expression of your commitment to what's coming out of this whole issue. I'd like to give our panel one more question to kind of contemplate, and that is really, we're talking about solutions here, and each of you has a very unique point of view and a unique area of influence. And I wanted to know if you could each talk about the kinds of steps that you would like to see us take regarding the area in which you really can speak from. State Senator Anthony Hardy Williams, you are obviously in the legislature and dealing with a vastly Republican right-wing political environment right now, and certainly there are efforts to have the Stand Your Ground law here in this state. I wonder if you can just start talking about what you see are some of the solutions, things that we need to know about, ways we can support change.
When we have right-wing groups, they are famous for saying things. We already have the laws on the books. So in this particular case, it's kind of obvious, and I have a little bit different opinion from the lawyers I've talked to about being tepid about prosecuting this person. I understand what happened that night. He was brought into a police station, and a set of facts presented themselves. And in fact, those stories changed. That means that night, a prosecutor on the ground said he should be prosecuted. There's nothing unusual for a circumstantial set of events to end up in someone being charged and being held. Matter of fact, in Philadelphia County, we have something we call stop and frisk. Mm-hmm. Happens every day. We are sued on a regular basis. The DA's office does it frequently. We have a standard, a very low standard, to actually charge someone and hold someone. Even if you have to wait to get to the point of where you charge them with a major crime of murder. There was more than enough information to have this person charged. The question would be corruption that will be uncovered in this process. And there's no doubt that there will be corruption that is uncovered in this process. There was an attorney from the prosecutor's office who suggested that we charge with manslaughter. That was changed. There was a person who came in who said that they were attacked with no scars. There was a person who was shot on the ground, and there were witnesses. There were witnesses who may not have seen the shooting, but saw the people involved in the set of circumstances. And most importantly, someone died. Someone died. Which raises the level of scrutiny and investigation in any normal set of circumstances. But here, it is most important that we recognize that the laws that exist, we don't need any more. We just need them to be executed. And frankly, even if at this point in time the local administration there decides to prosecute him, I think the Justice Department should be and has to remain involved because of the level of corruption that occurred in terms of removing the charges and allowing this person to go free. In Pennsylvania, we do have a conservative body who are involved, and I would suspect that any momentum that was behind any similar cousin kind of legislation that happened in Florida has now been slowed, if not stopped dramatically in its path, because even the Republican governor and the Republican legislators are now talking about modifying the current law that exists in Florida because it opened up this set of circumstances that created this tragedy in Florida.
Joy? I think that for a long time, Black America has had the idea that if one of us is home, then all of us are home. And the reality is that none of us is home until all of us is home. So in other words, if someone makes it to a high-ranking position, we then put all of our hopes in that person, and we put all of our expectations in that person. And in our so doing, though, we suddenly become complacent. We suddenly relinquish our own personal responsibility for achievement and success. And so I think one of the things that we can do individually is begin to understand how to be proud of the success of our people, how to support the success of our people, but not to personally rest because that success has come to them and think that there are no more issues that we need to handle. When Obama won the presidency, it did not signal that there would be no longer inequal situations in our country. It was a tremendous, a groundbreaking success and victory for us and for the country. However, we all know that there continue to be inequalities, not only in our community, in our government, in every system that we have in this country, there's inequality. And so there's much to be done. Our country was built on the backs of Black slaves. And we don't have a structure in America that is designed to liberate Black people. We just don't have that structure. In 2012, hatred exists, and it's moved about in families, in organizations, in businesses, in government, in social media. It's everywhere. And so we know all of this, and I guess the question and answer that I would bring is where are we going to place our focus at this time? And I think some of what we can do has to do with reflection and self-assessment. It's not only about what we expect to come to us, but it is also about what we are bringing to the table in ways that mean that we are not complacent, and in ways that mean that we will continue to stand up in our particular corner of the world and do what is required. Sometimes we have opportunities that come to us, and we do not take hold of those opportunities. I think sometimes we try to live through maybe some of the successes of people that we consider to be leaders, but our leaders need for us to also come into our own success so that we can help move the situation along.
I'm going to interrupt you only because we are we're going to try to speed through the rest of our panel members so that we can get to our audience and get more participation. But thank you so much for that comment. Councilman Kenyatta Johnson, I know you're itching to say something, so what are your thoughts about solutions?
It's twofold. One, this movement right here reminds me of the Genesis 6 movement, and somebody mentioned earlier, are we experiencing a generational shift as it relates to this new generation and our focus and stepping up and standing out against injustices that are taking place throughout the United States? And so I want to encourage particularly the individuals, the young people of my generation who are stepping out on this issue. But I also want to encourage us, and probably because I deal with this on a day-to-day basis, and it's a totally separate issue, but at the same time, I think it's somewhat interrelated. And that's how do we go about taking this energy, but also inspiring and encouraging a generation of young people who have no focus. And what I mean by that, I deal with the issue. For instance, there was a rally on Monday in Love Park, but I couldn't go to that rally because I was at 27th and Dickinson Street dealing with a homicide that just took place, two young men inside an Asian restaurant. This particular case is a totally different circumstance, and I clearly understand that. But I also hope that the energy that we have as we move forward, and I think when you're fighting an injustice, it brings something more out of you because you just know it's not right. It doesn't feel right. But the other component is when two young men are trapped inside a corner store because they can't get out because two other young men are coming inside the store with guns, I feel a certain type of way. And so hopefully we'll get to the point where this new generation of activism, as we move forward, we find a way to encourage and uplift, because what you just said, sister, makes so much point. The more we become successful, there's still a generation out there that need help and support, that need to be uplifted. There were no doctors in my neighborhood. There were no, for me, the professional in my neighborhood was the deacon in my church because he had a tie on. I'm first-generation college graduate, but I stay in my neighborhood so I can be a sense of inspiration and hope. And so hopefully what will come out of this is that we can go to the next level and try to encourage another generation that really need a sense of direction, and more importantly, a sense of hope. Because I come across so many young men and young ladies who do not have a sense of hope of what they want to do with their lives. And so hopefully as we move forward to the next level, we can begin to tackle it. But first and foremost, I can't get away from, I wanted to raise my hand because I'm not the lawyer, but I do understand this. If you're a police officer in the city of Philadelphia and you shoot someone, you're on death duty. Real simple. They take your gun and you're on desk duty.
Mm-hmm.
And then they go do an investigation. They go find out the facts and the circumstances. This whole case, I mean, you 220, young man, 115 pounds, we didn't test you for drugs. We take you in, let you leave. What about the evidence that might have been on him when they let him go? The evidence is gone. And so for me, this particular case is wrong. It's an injustice. It happens on a regular basis. And without a shadow of a doubt, I know for a fact if the shoe was on the other foot, you'd be locked up, you're guilty till you're proven innocent, and then you have to figure out the rest down the line, because I see it as an elected official on a regular basis, somebody coming for some help from my office, and then when they get the phone call that an elected official is calling on their behalf, either the facts come out or we decide to let a person go. So it's not always 102. Now I'll wrap up on this one. Councilman Curtis Jones, from a policy standpoint, and I'm not just going at the Philadelphia Police Department, I support the cops, I support Ramsey, but it has to be a check and balance in our system, and particularly the racial profiling cases that have been taking place. And obviously, if we didn't have that problem in Philadelphia, it wouldn't be a lawsuit against the Philadelphia Police Department. But Councilman Curtis Jones was a councilman for this district. I told him I'd give him a shout out while I'm here. He has a bill that will make the Philadelphia Police Advisory Board a permanent board. And that's basically a silver board that takes complaints from the people when there is an actual injustice that takes place against a civilian. And it happens more frequently than not. And I think it's pieces of legislation like that that will probably, more importantly, put a check and balance and hold the system accountable, regardless of who's actually the perpetrator. So that's my two cents.
Okay, Curtis Wilkerson?
I would just like to say that, we're talking about solutions. I think we do have the solution, and we're the solution. We need to actually stay mobilized, get organized. I think we dropped the ball after the Obama election. We had so many young kids involved and engaged, and they wanted to keep going on with their involvement in, the political process. While we have this moment here, I think we need to seize that opportunity. And actually, Mike Check, keep those young folks engaged, past the Trayvon Martin. Once Zimmerman is prosecuted, hey, keep them involved. Find another issue to say, hey, we need to keep you guys organized so that if an issue like this happens again, hey, we're already there, we're ready to fight. That's the best thing we need to do, is they be organized and be mobilized.
Thank you. Kevin Hardman, you mentioned before that we don't have a stand your ground law, and it's interesting that you said that, because at several of the rallies that I've been to, people went out and spoke out and said that we did have that. So can you make that distinction for us?
Really quickly, we have something called a Castle Doctrine. The stand your ground law says that anywhere you are, you can meet force with force, which means that if you have the lawful right to be where you are on the streets, so if I'm walking down the street, I have a right to defend myself. Everybody has that right. Self-defense is a natural law. What it says, though, that you have to be threatened with force that would be a serious threat to your person or somebody that you love. And if you have the opportunity to retreat, you can run. It also says you can't be the initial aggressor. That's the state of the law on self-defense. Probably about two years ago, there was works, and it finally became law that we have the Castle Doctrine now in Pennsylvania. What that means is that, let's say I have a burglar in my home. I open my door, and I see the burglar in the kitchen. Formerly, you would have to retreat right out your front door and go out the back door. Right back out, because you have an opportunity to run. Now you can now protect your property with the same amount of force you would protect your person. So if you can't, you're not forced to run from your property. So, in essence, if you have the Castle Doctrine, which we do have now in Pennsylvania, I open my door, I walk into my house, and I hear some rustling upstairs, I can pull out my pistol, go upstairs and investigate, and become the murderer that I am. And then the Stand Your Ground law pretty much allows you to just exploit your
firearm. That's outside the home.
Outside the home, wherever you want to be. If you're at the basketball, if you're at the park, you're out there with some kids, and if a kid comes up on you and jumps on you, all of a sudden now you got justification to shoot them. So that's the Stand Your Ground law.
Okay.
I also want to touch on, and this is something, this goes back to, because I actually agree with two things that have been said so far. One is corruption. Senator Hardy Williams pointed on out the corruption. The luckiest thing that we have is that Barack Obama signed a law in 2009 that expanded hate crimes. It used to be that a federal investigation, the feds didn't have jurisdiction to investigate a hate crime unless you were doing a federally protected activity. So you're trying to vote, you're trying to go to school, you're trying to move into a home, and then when there was hate, it was hate motivation, then the feds could investigate. Now, as of 2009, with the new law, it was also the law that allowed sexual preference. So if you actually hate on someone because of their sexual preference, it also expanded hate crimes to anything. So if you do anything based on race, now the feds have the power. So that ties back to a solution. I think the big problem here with two things, there are no checks and balances, and then there's corruption. There's too much institutional power. Police chiefs, district attorneys, they have unfettered discretion. And a lot of the times, the decisions that are made in these types of cases, there's no need for transparency. Mm. You can just say, we don't comment on ongoing law enforcement investigations. Mm. That's what we can
do. You do that very well.
We lower our voice and we get real serious and say, the district attorney's office has decided not to comment on law enforcement investigations. What can we do? I think that we have to challenge the establishment. You know, we talked about Philadelphia Police Department and racial profiling, and I always get really weird because, you know, the people that they consider the most racist cops are black cops.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I know that there are guns out there, and I know that there are a lot of cops who are accused of being racist who aren't. They just have really good knowledge of, you know, why is this guy standing on 52nd and Market? I work in this neighborhood. I work this beat 7 days a week. I've never seen this guy. He's obviously looking for drugs, but and that person may be white, and they walk up to this white guy on 52nd and Market, racial profiling. And I coach officers sometimes and say, listen, if you can establish your familiarity with this neighborhood, you know all the neighbors, you help the old lady that lives on that street take out her trash sometimes, you know that man doesn't belong in that neighborhood at 4 o'clock in the morning, that's called good police work. That's not so stupid. And I'm not saying we don't have a race issue. Please don't think that I'm saying it. Nevertheless, there have been instances in Philadelphia where this type of instance could have occurred, and the individual who got the hush that made it all go away was black. It happens.
Hmm.
If you're the son of the most powerful or the daughter of the most powerful, in a city where we have a powerful black establishment that makes things non-transparent, where decisions are made where we can't see, what we have to do as people, regardless of race, color, creed, is hold our leadership accountable. Because there were leaders in Sanford who made decisions, and I'm gonna tell you what the federal probe is gonna look like. You see how this panel is sitting here? They're gonna line up everybody that was on that panel, that was down in at the police department, they're gonna say, well, who made the decisions? Let us see the emails. Well, who was the one that said take the cuffs off of him? Who was the one that said not to do gunshot residue testing? Who didn't take pictures of his injuries? Because these are the types of things that a normal investigation would do. Now, Sanford can sit back and say, listen, we got one person getting murdered a year. We don't know how to conduct a murder investigation. That sounds logical. It sounds good until the feds start putting pressure in, until we have panels like this. And finally, somebody's going to say, it was him. And then they're going to start rolling, and all of a sudden, that's how it's going to work. That's how it works. And luckily, we now have this hate crime bill that will allow the feds to come in. Because before that, when the son or daughter, whether they be, you know, Irish, whatever, when they said, look, daddy, I messed up. What do I do? And daddy makes that phone call. We, the normal citizens, we know there's something wrong with it. But there's nothing we can do because there's no transparency. Because the establishment has made it so that if Malia Obama goes out and does something, she can call daddy and make sure that nothing happens to her. That is not the type of world we want to live in. That's not justice. So what we have to do is make sure that we challenge power. We have to challenge institutional power. So we can rally all we want, but then we have to turn around and ask the people in power, what are you going to do about it?
Yeah, hold everybody accountable, regardless.
Hold everyone accountable.
Gotcha. Dr. Kafalas,
Back to the millennial issue, I've heard recent studies that said that the millennial generation is more tolerant than previous generations. And I wonder if you think that that is true, number one, and if it is true, how that reflects on our solutions.
Racially tolerant?
Racially, sexual orientation, all that.
Well, I think that this generation, when it comes to this issue, I think it was shocking to them. I think that they may have felt complacent when they look in the White House and they look at mayors and prominent government officials all over the nation, and they think of Martin Luther King as another time. But the Trayvon Martin case has clearly awakened them, and that is, I think, young people across the racial spectrum, and race means so much a very different thing now than it did in 1965 or 1955. We have more biracial, mixed-race people in the United States. In New York City, 50% of the people under the age of 30 are the children of immigrants. George Zimmerman himself is half Peruvian, which, you know, I think really complicates a black and white version of this story. But that said, what I find really exciting, because I'm always an optimist, was the campaign that seems to be growing in response, the questions that young people are asking. And there's so much in this story. It's such a complicated story. And I think those of a certain age want to tell a story in a certain way, and the younger people are looking at the story very differently. And they're asking, I think, maybe smarter questions and better questions, because while there's the horror of why did an innocent young man with a bag of Skittles and a bottle of tea get assassinated walking home, I mean, my 8-year-old son wept when he heard that story. Mm-hmm. What do you mean? I could be walking with Skittles and someone would shoot me? But at the same time, I think there's so much more going on in the story. And in particular, I hope it gets our younger generation in particular, and some of the old folks, and myself included, to really refocus our attention on how racial injustices, which still exist, operate in this new world, because they're more slippery, they're more invisible, they're more difficult to make sense of. And it was so striking to me that people started blaming the hoodie.
Right.
Somehow the hoodie had set the stage. And if you walk into any school in Philadelphia, they have big posters that say, "No hoodies."
Mm-hmm.
And it's code, right? It's code for a certain kind of person and a certain kind of behavior. And the other, I think, huge issue that Trayvon brings up is the reality of black-on-black violence, the incredible rates of violence among young black men in our society, where somehow they are seen as so dangerous, so out of control, so terrifying, that of course I would shoot one down,
yeah.
Like an animal.
Yeah.
And that, I think, that is really the ugliness that maybe this younger generation...
You're taking out of go for it.
Well, I'm sorry, but I mean, the sad reality of your comment regarding, and I like how you put it in the context, the black-on-black violence and how that also has a correlation with how this young man might have been perceived by Zimmerman aggressively, right? And the sad part, sometime when I would read probably one of the worst blogs in the city, and they'll probably, you know, look after me after this comment, but it is what it is. But if you go on Philly.com, they have like and Philly.com, they have a comment section.
The comment section
pretty much expressed everything you just said in a nutshell. And it was a reflection of a perception of African-American young men, and basically saying in a nutshell it was acceptable for this guy to respond the way he responded, you know? And that's just a small part of a mentality
yeah.
that's out there, you know it, but you have to really pay attention. There's no more covert.
That's an excellent point.
It's poison.
Yeah. Reverend Louise?
I would like to answer the question, what can we do about the violence? I believe that was a part of the question. And I think one of the things that we can do is remember that most young people are looking for leadership. They are looking for leadership. In the African country, it is the older ones that mentor the younger ones. They look to older ones to hand down and to prepare them, teach them, tell them what to do. So the older one mentors the younger one. And I think the one thing that is missing in our society today is there really isn't the leadership from older ones that there should be. And young people are left to make their own decisions on their own to try to figure out what is the right thing to do and which way they should go. I really hope the one thing that would come from such a meeting as this is that older folk will reach down and start mentoring our young men and seeing the good that is in them and bringing out the best that is in them. All of them have something good that we can tap in and bring out.
Mm-hmm.
And all of us owe it to our brothers to remember that we are our brothers and our sisters' keepers. And when we see one possibly even walking alone by themselves, or maybe they may not be walking the way we feel that they should, we should be able to go to them, to ask them if they need your help, to extend a hand to them, to help them get to where they have to go. If we don't do that, we're dealing with the lost generation. So my final comment is, again, thank you, young men and young women, for taking the ball and bouncing it now so that the nation can see that you're tired and that something must be done now, that there is an injustice that has taken place in our nation with one who did not deserve it, and therefore there's a penalty that you pay for injustice. And I think that officer in his tribe should be convicted like any other killer, even though he was a policeman. He took a life, and there's a consequence whenever you take a life. Thank you.
All right. Okay, this is the opportunity that I've been talking about before for all of you out there in our audience to participate with comments or questions to our panel members, suggestions of what you think to be the next steps that we need to take. I think what something that was so inspiring on Monday was that I don't even know how many young people from the University of Pennsylvania, but there's a huge crowd that just marched up to Love Park, and they were all your age. And there are so many young people in so many of these rallies and individuals that I participated in. And it was really amazing. And in spite, I remain optimistic. I see so much good in all of you and all of the young people that I encounter. And so I'd like to invite you to step up. I know it's a little nerve-wracking sometimes to be the first one, but who would like to jump in and provide a comment or a question for our panel members? Okay, come on up. There's a microphone right up there or there so that we can all hear you.
Or could it take the mic?
Or the mic could come to you, either way. Tell us your name and your comment or question.
My name is Mark Holmes. When I first heard of the Trayvon Martin situation, there's two words that came to mind immediately. One is paranoia, and another one is stereotype. Let me explain what I mean. The Zimmerman case is based on paranoia. He of an individual was very, very paranoid, a black man. But that paranoia is born by stereotypes.
Mm-hmm.
One, the news media. Night after night is negative stories about black men. There's a lot of good black men out there, but you'll never know it. Number two, the rap videos. The gangster rappers who are glorifying this life of going to jail, being a thug, and wearing a hoodie that symbolizes that. So what I think is two things have to happen. We have to remove these stereotypes about us. We really do. And one thing we have to do is we have to try to focus more on the people like Brother Williams, Brother Kenyatta, and try to talk about the people who are trying to make a difference. And if we hear more positive stories and see more positive stories, then that will inspire more of us to do things, do positive things. Even in the athletic community, even with the entertainers, we have to inspire them to get involved and do better things. But now you have these reality shows where you got black people arguing, calling each other bitches and whores. This is not good. You might think it's funny, but it's not funny because it's making you look bad. It really is. You might watch these shows, you know, what's the one? Real Housewives of Atlanta,
Basketball Wives.
This is horrible. Jerry Springer, then you got rap videos, people walking out tattoos on their face. What kind of nonsense is that? And yet, I'm not only concerned about the Zimmerman today, I'm concerned about the Zimmermans of tomorrow. Because you can rest assured, this ain't the last of this kind of thing. Am I right? You're going to hear more and more cases of this until we start doing things to prevent this. Another thing that bothers me, I look around, I see a number of black women here. Where are the black men? I'm a member of Kappa Alpha Psi.
Turn around. There's some black men here in the audience.
Yeah, but what? Two or three?
True.
Where are the Kappas? Where are the Qs? Where are the Masons? I heard that. But what I'm saying is, black men need to take more of a responsibility role. We need to come out and take care of our, you know, Ms. Williams said that the older people have to help the younger, the men have to help the boys. That's all I have to say right now. Thank you, Chris.
Thank you very much. Excellent comments. Anyone on the panel would like to make a quick reaction to that comment? Yes, Joy. Or? Yeah.
I think we have to realize, too, we're talking about media. I think that's an excellent point that he made because, you know, the 2010 census said that there are 63% of white Americans and about 12.6 black Americans. And in the news, TV news media, about 79% are white American and hold jobs. And, but in the TV news general manager's positions are 95% held by white people. And so I think when we talk about what comes across, you know, the news media, the idea that 95% of the general managers are white Americans, you have less of an empathy for other races. And the more that we understand that the things that we do with our life impact situations like this, the more that we realize that we should go after our dreams in the sense of roles that we can take in life, even in jobs, the more that we'll be able to see ourselves in some of the positions that would make decisions about what we see in television and news.
I think you make a great point, and I think underlying that point was the recent laying off of Sarah Glover from the Philadelphia Inquirer. Sarah Glover is, for those who don't know who she is, she's an African-American woman who is an amazing photographer and also a videographer and part of the whole internet news social media
but, you know, last hired, first fired. And in fact, you're seeing exactly what Joy's saying, is that the people in power, the major media, are not necessarily people of color. But the good news is that we have this whole new world, this whole brand new world of social media. We have the color curve. We have Mic Check 1-2. We have all these new voices out there. We have Facebook. I mean, a million hoodies for Trayvon. That is a movement that just took fire. And there are reporters out there who've been trying to push people to tweet about it, and that's really, I think, a large reason, a large part of why we are so engaged in this issue. Yes, over there. Say who you are.
My name is Tyree Evans, former pole marketer of Pioneer Chapter, Cap Office High. But I was listening to the discussion, and I totally can relate to Kenyatta. And the conversation is very mind-boggling when people blame the hoodie as for the sense of him getting murdered. And people saying, oh, you know, in Black America, when you see a hoodie, it means something, it means something. Well, when a girl goes out to the club and she wears a short skirt and she gets raped that night, does that say, rape me, that skirt says that? If you're familiar with, like, the movie Takers, if you've seen it, if you're familiar with it, those gentlemen wore suits and talk about profit sharing and were robbing people. Nobody assumed that they were going to do what they were doing. They thought they were good businessmen. So you better tell me that because he had a hoodie on, he deserved to be murdered. That's not right. Now, as far as, I read a quote that said, with every good revolution, blood has to be shed. So, Trayvon started a revolution. So I said, Martin marched for Trayvon. Trayvon was a victim of hate crimes. So you can look at it how you want to look at it, but Zimmerman fathered something with the Supreme Court. He made 48 phone calls to the police before he went outside. His mother was involved in law. So it was a big bet, like the gentleman said. It was going to happen. He was going to kill someone that was African American. But I was sitting there writing, and Trayvon Martin case is embedded in a culture of African American history. Not African American history. I wrote down some things. The Scottsboro Boys, Emmett Till, Sammy Davis, Black Wall Street, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, Malcolm Mahill, the Genesis 6, Fred Hampton, and the list goes on and on. So you can go on and say that, you know, this case is going to have an ill perception. Troy Davis is maybe a cop. Well, allegedly, we're going to say that. Troy Davis allegedly murdered a cop. Death sentence. He's dead. There were so many holes in that case. This is the flip side of the case. A white man murdered a young black man. He's free. And all that is cool. Now, a lot of discrepancy about black men. I understand that. A lot of debate about black men.
Can you make your final point?
Okay, this is my final. I'm just going to jump to my other point.
You got a lot of good points.
But my final point is, Barack Obama stood up and said something, and the world went against it. White America went against it. Let's say that. White America went against Obama standing up for Trayvon. And I applauded it against anybody because Obama did something that no other president in the United States of America would ever do. They wouldn't even acknowledge this case. You know, Bush, Katrina happened. He acted like he never existed. So, you know, I support Obama, his endeavors, the lawyers who wear the hoodies, the Supreme Court justice who wear the hoodies. But at the same token, the revolution takes place at grassroots level. So it takes place right here, right now. Thank you for your participation. Thank you for the movement. I wish I had more time, but thank you.
Thank you. You got a lot of information packed into that few minutes there. Go ahead, State Senator Anthony Hardy Williams.
So, I was going to try to be quiet, but I want to make sure that we don't lose. I want to go through some checklists of things. The Castle Doctrine in Pennsylvania. The significance behind the Castle Doctrine in Pennsylvania, it was amended. It was described as an ability to defend your property in your home, but most recently it was amended to allow you to defend your property outside your home. So that means you can come out if your car is being stolen, you also can be involved in that process of taking a gun to defend your piece of property. The law that was talked about with President Obama, it's not sexual preference, it's sexual orientation. The issue the gentleman raised about stereotypes, this is a case about stereotypes. And of course, we tend to sort of micromanage that conversation. This is a nation of stereotypes. Jews run the money. Asians know more about math and science. Italians historically part of the mob. We can go down the list. The question is the significance behind our stereotypes, and frankly, we are self-inflicted with stereotypes, because with all due respect, we're all here talking about hoodies tonight. The truth is, if you walk out of here at 12 o'clock tonight, you're walking down your street, some boy walks up to you with bag jeans down around his ankles, a hoodie over his head, you are going to momentarily wonder what's going to happen to you. No different than Chris Rock talks about Martin Luther King Boulevard, any place in America. It ain't the safest place in America. To solve your problem, you got to be truthful about our problems. Some of these wounds are self-inflicted.
Mm-hmm.
And there's circumstances around, and I guess my main point is, we came here tonight to talk about how we're going to pack Trayvon Martin. That's why I came here. Now, I know we can go through all the litany of things that are going on. This needs to be elevated to a point of, he needs to be arrested, he needs to be charged, he needs to be prosecuted, he needs to be thrown in jail, and frankly, I don't know what they're allowed to do in Florida, he needs to be burned. Now, all the other set of circumstances that we talk around, that's fine. And I can empathize with it. But I get frustrated with us as a community because we do exactly this. We get splintered into all these side conversations before you know it. We're walking out the room, we forgot why we got here. Like an argument between a husband and wife. The main issue is that this country has a responsibility to prosecute those people who've committed a crime. He's committed a crime. Period. The fact that he's a black man, and that we suspect, and understand this, we weren't trapping in black versus white. This guy, this dude is mixed up. He's a mutt, just like most white Americans are mutts now. So it's going to be troubling in terms of how you make it a hate crime. And the only way you can attach this to the stereotypes. But that said, I don't care whether it's a hate crime or not. It was a murder. And he should be prosecuted. People of lesser standards have been prosecuted. Emmett Till was killed. Scottsdale boys were prosecuted of a lesser standard. I'll go out of here tonight talking about it. I came in here tonight talking about it. I helped organize it to talk about it. This is about getting this man prosecuted. How you do it? Let me talk to you. You join organizations. NAACP is dying at the vine because the next generation hasn't taken it over. You already take it over. So you can become prosecutors, judges, Supreme Court justices, so that the process of justice is evenly handed. We need to no longer come to just auditoriums and talk about it and go home and call WRD. No. It ain't about us dressing up on Saturday night. It's about us talking about Saturday night and then doing something Monday morning in a grassroots way that they did generations ago.
Oh, speak it.
So that to me is the, you know, and I'm listening to everybody talk about their generation. Understand, I was a thug too. I'm glad y'all can relate to Kenyatta. I was as hellraiser as he was. Okay?
I don't know about that. I think Kenyatta might dispute that. But.
Nah, and he might dispute it, but he wasn't with me, so he
wasn't. Oh, okay. We'll have to talk later.
So all I'm saying is that all the nuances that we get sort of caught up on, we are one. One community has a voice, has a possibility. Hopefully we'll elevate it to some set of circumstances that will drive action by those of us who hold these offices and are responsible and such to do such. Thank you.
Thank you for focusing the conversation, Senator Anthony Hardy Williams. All right, you ready?
Hello.
Tell us who you are and go ahead and comment.
I am Dee Dukes, and I am a graduate student here at St. Joseph's University. First, I thank the panel for coming out and each and every one of you who came out to support this movement, I guess you want to call it. So I have three comments. I don't advocate killing, but I do advocate justice. And justice, my three comments would be prayer. We took prayer out of the school some time ago. I think we need prayer in this situation, in every situation that we deal with. Number two, more church involvement. I don't think that our churches are getting involved as they should. And the last comment, I would agree with State Representative Bishop in mentoring, getting together and mentoring the young people. My children grew up in a kind of violent neighborhood as well, but I kept them in church, and that was how I was able to get by, get through, and raise them to be good children like they are today. So we really need church involvement, more mentors, and prayer.
All right, thank you very much.
Okay,
please, go ahead.
I just want to touch on that. I do agree that
since the public school system took religious activities out of school, I like to see the numbers of, you know, violence and how it, you know, spiked over those years since they took religious activities out of schools. I think they should actually, you know, implement them back into schools, no matter what your religion is. Give them 5 minutes to pray to whomever their God is. If there is no God, hey, don't pray to no God then. You know, but that needs to be, you know, something that, you know, we need to focus and tell, you know, our youth that, yeah, you need to feed your mind, your body, and your spirit. You know, that's three things that you definitely need to focus on. And, you know, like Senator, the sad thing is that this is a recurring theme. And the thing of it is that we can't just be always on the defense. We need to be in the offense. And that, you know, once, you know, like I said, Zimmerman is prosecuted, hey, it shouldn't stop here. You know, if another, you know, injustice like this happened again, we need to be ready and roll out. And another thing on the stereotype thing, I don't want to get off topic, you know, hey, I listen to hip-hop music. I'm pretty sure a large majority of folks here probably listen to hip-hop music. You know, just I was lucky enough to have people around me that mentored me and showed me that there was actually real life outside of, you know, hip-hop and music and to take me out of that square block radius. You know, just because, you know, you know, a Caucasian listens to rock doesn't mean he does acid. I mean, you can't put every stereotype on a black male. That's what I want to say.
I think Dr. Kifalas, did you
want to say something? Very, very quickly, and well, you know, I believe very profoundly in prayer and spirituality. I think it's also very important for us to, I think it was Senator Williams talked about, seeing the truth and for all its ugliness and all its complexity. And one of the things that we have to see is that our young African American men in particular live in such close proximity to danger and violence that while many Americans live in places where their schools and their communities are resources that help them, that enhance their opportunities, so many of our young African-American people, because of segregation, because of poverty, because of aggressive policing, and the number, and when we were talking about the ped stops, it's 200,000 ped stops every year in Philadelphia, in a city of 1.3 million, and they ain't stopping the guys in Rittenhouse Square.
Was that number 200,000?
Yes, 200,000.
Wow.
100,000 every year. The ACLU filed suit after some activism here in the city. But we have an African American mayor, half an African American police chief, and we cannot underestimate that. I compare it to chemotherapy, where if you use this kind of medicine, it will work to a point, but after a while, it is poison. That doesn't get only the malignant or the problem that you're trying to handle. It starts getting healthy cells and it starts poisoning your community, where people don't believe in the police, where people don't want to come forward, and it makes people think that if there's 200,000 ped stops in Philadelphia every year, there must be a reason. And so it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. So I want us to remember that as fabulous and as amazing as the African American community here in Philadelphia is, that they have burdens that no other community has, and that they should not be silent about what that means and the vulnerabilities that exposes our young people to.
Yeah, I just wanted one small tidbit. Beyond this actual case, back to how else can we mobilize and use this energy that we have? Clearly, the African American community, usually for the most part, correctly, probably receive less support in a variety of different areas when it comes to services, when it comes to programs, if our leaders aren't doing their job. And so part of this also to take away, because I'm a politician and I look at things from a political lens, through political lens as well, is you have to get involved with the political process. as a part. I would love to see a million folks come out on the parkway and do a voter registration drive. And so the next time that Tom Corbett goes up for re-election, we'll vote him out. Mm. Just to show that this new generation, like, we're tired and we're not taking it anymore. Because when you look at the budget, that just $40 billion from education. Well, I don't. It wasn't $40 billion, was it, Senator?
No, it wasn't $40 billion.
About $1 billion. Mm-hmm. But put it like this: when I was a state rep, they severely cut public education, and then when I became a city councilman this year, they severely cut higher education. So we're going to decimate education from K through 12. Then I'm going to come back next year, and I'm going to decimate public higher education as it relates to the 14 state universities, and let alone the 20% reduction in cuts that's going to go through Department of Public Welfare. That's a whole lot to deal with on both ends. And so while we're aggressively trying to address the violence issue through education and social service programs, right, there's another component from a policy standpoint that I encourage all of you to get a copy of the budget. It's free. It's online. And look at how your money is being spent. And I also encourage you to make sure that your legislator, your elected official, is doing their job to make sure we bring on resources to kind of help address this from another
angle. Okay, we have another person out in the audience who wanted to comment. What's your name and what's your comment or question?
Good evening. My name is Yassine Zumar. I work with the Sultan Jihad Academic Community Foundation. I have like a question for Assistant District Attorney and a comment. Well, I'd like to know, what is your procedure in handling police complaints? Because I noticed that whenever police commit a series of acts, right, it's always like the final act they commit. I know when you read about in the paper, they have committed a series of the acts, okay? My statement, comment I'll make about is that I'm surprised that this is 2012 and that a lot of police officers still have this mentality that if you're black and you're driving an expensive car, a Jaguar or a Benz, you know, there's something wrong with that. Like, even Kenyatta, he was stopped. And the apex of his statement is, look at Joe Williams. Mm-hmm. This is a state representative, right? He was in his own district, right, and identified himself as a state representative. And they still handcuffed him and threw him in a car as a common criminal. So I want to know, what is, like, your procedure as far as handling police complaints? Because I want to be more clear. I'm just trying to say that I found out when a person's family is suspended, you realize there's a series of complaints that was lodged against them that for some reason apparently they was ignored until until the extreme happened.
Let's let Kevin Hyman respond to that.
The thing is that police complaints aren't handled by the district attorney's office. They're handled by the Philadelphia Police Department. That is what Kenyatta spoke about with the Curtis Jones finding a bill that would allow that agency, which is, I believe, what's the name of it? The Police Advisory Commission, to be permanent, because right now they're just like a toothless agency. That's the best way to describe it. They have a backlog. They only have one paid employee. So if you complain, you pretty much call the secretary, but the secretary is also the investigator, and the investigator is also the boss, and they have to write a memo. So you know, you talk to herself. She's writing a memo to herself, and then they make a recommendation to Commissioner Ramsey. The thing about it is that Commissioner Ramsey, like, I'm an at-will employee. If I say something stupid up here right now, Seth can fire me tomorrow. The city has a contract with the individual police officers. So Ramsey is he's a city employee, employed at will. He can get fired by Michael Nutter tomorrow. If a police officer gets fired, he shoots somebody and it's not okay, he first, internal affairs investigates police officers. They make a complaint to the Police Advisory Commission. They can't do anything about it. And even if the commissioner fires a police officer, he can go back to Philadelphia Police Department and file for a review, and the union can get him his job back. So, you know, that has a lot to do with, like I said, established power, because, you know, I don't have a stance publicly about what. Put it like this: a lot more police officers have. I think three police officers were convicted in the last 2 weeks by the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office. One for an incident that occurred in West Philly with a with a young lady who performed a sexual act in a police car, another police officer who was just convicted of like hitting a woman at the Piazza. Like these, my boss has prosecuted police officers. It happens. But at the same time, you know, absent a conviction, absent, and I'm going to say this, it's a part of the stereotype. When a young black man has his money stolen by a police officer, and he accuses that police officer of stealing his money, and he has 15 convictions for theft, 4 convictions for robbery, 2 convictions for selling drugs, and then he doesn't have anybody. He's like, oh, all my friends were out there, but none of them will come to court and testify with me because they're all drug dealers. Because surprisingly, it's the weirdest thing. You know, the whole stop snitching thing apparently applies to police too. Because like, if the cop punches me in the mouth, none of my friends will come to court and testify and help me. So they don't even like taking the stand in those situations. But that's the problems that we deal with as law enforcement, because when do we know? I mean, it's just like any other time. The 200,000 pet stop number comes from, and I'll be, the 200,000 pet stop number comes from the idea that with racial profiling, they require the police officers to document on paper why they stopped someone, when they stopped them, what was the reason, and then they get a percentage of the numbers of those people who are African American. There are plenty of arguments that everybody knows as to why more black people are stopped. Racism, well, they're the ones committing the crimes, or stereotypes. She described it in the best manner in which I've ever heard it described. It's like chemotherapy. I don't know how to answer that. I don't know how to fix it. No, I don't think anyone. I think that people work very hard to try to figure out how they can fix it. But when you got 368 murders a year, you know, you can't tell all the police officers to say, like, everybody, don't stop nobody until we figure out how we're going to fix this. So it's like one of those necessary evils. I think that we will come to a point where we have a better way in which we can deal with the crime in the city. But I don't think it's going to come from law enforcement. Law enforcement chases bad guys.
And one more question.
Okay, really quick, because we've got a bunch of people.
This is a short stack question. It just says that since Ramsey been charged, we know Philip has a lot of violence, but it has decreased on his watch. I just want to know, has Philip, the police shootings, have that decreased or increased on his watch?
I have no idea. Okay, I really do.
Right. Just do a question down. Yes, over here you have a comment. The lady right there, yes?
I have a comment. There certainly is spirit going through the United States in Philadelphia, the spirit of revolution. Basically, what I want to say is I'd like to join in grassroots organizations that are professional. I'd like to join the NAACP, the Urban League, and see what I can do as an individual to bring about change.
So you've been inspired.
I've been inspired.
All right.
But something is going on and has been going on. This was going to happen, as someone said. We can have all kind of task force. Forces, we can have everything, but we've got to get back to square one, the individual. You've got to embrace other people. We've been divided. We're being conquered, not just black children, unless you really don't know what time it is, everybody's child. It's a class war, my belief, going on right now. When it gets to that stage, things are going to start to really deteriorate, and we are going to come back to God's head. But I'd like to see people, especially black people, and people in power, regardless of which race
right.
you are, go inside yourself and treat other people as you would have them treat you. That's a good starting place. We've got to get rid of
okay,
that.
Okay, Jonetta would like to respond back to that comment.
Well, I just want to give, and this is just, I just want to tie it to Trayvon real quick. There are two organizations that we have in the city that are really, really important. One is PDAC. PDAC is a group of people who meet with the police every week, and the police pretty much say, this is where the shootings have been, this is the crime that we've been occurring, these are the reasons that we're, this is how we're going to fix it. And this is the captain, like, this is the captain of the district. And the funny thing is like, I was assigned to the 17th district, which is Kenyatta's district. And there's also the Philadelphia Youth Aid Panels, which is where a whole bunch of community members come in, and they sit as judges for juveniles who have been arrested for the first time, and they try to steer them in the right direction. How this ties back to Trayvon, and this is something that I see in our community a lot, and I think we can change it. How did this cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs man Zimmerman become the Town Watch president? I mean, think about it. The thing is I go to PDAC meetings in the 17th district, which is probably one of the most plague shooting areas. The president of the PDAC there was an older woman. She's about 70-something years old on an oxygen tank. There were four older women who came to every meeting. They knew every drug dealer's name in the neighborhood. They told the police everything that happened. I was the only black man there other than the police officer, and I was the only person under the age of 50. So when I'm saying, like, in Philly, this happens because the Town Watch man is Zimmerman. How does a man who, if you listen to those radio tapes, he sounds like a heathen. They always get away. I've got to go get them. That's what he said. So, and I just want you guys to realize that law enforcement is something that you can take into your own hands, but not in the manner in which Zimmerman did. You can be there for the kid who falls and makes a mistake. You can be there telling the police that that officer needs to be pulled off the street because he's done these complaints. But the thing is that you got to embrace it.
All right, over here, tell us your name and your comment or question.
Good evening. My name is Marcel Pratt. I'm a corporate attorney here in Philadelphia, and before that, I worked in the Civil Rights Division of the City of Philadelphia Law Department. My first comment is a point of clarification, and Senator Williams can correct me if I'm wrong, but Pennsylvania is a stand-your-ground state, and what I would call a qualified stand-your-ground state, because you can stand your ground if someone brandishes a knife or a gun or some other deadly weapon. So I just want to get it out the way. My second comment is that I think the stand-your-ground law sort of is a distraction to what really happened. I don't think George Zimmerman was not arrested because of the stand your ground law. I think he was not arrested because he shot a black boy. So I think this whole blame on the stand your ground law is misplaced. Because at the end of the day, you know, there was no show of deadly force. I mean, unless George Zimmerman was, you know, has a lethal allergy to Skittles, then, I mean, there was no deadly force. So I don't, you know, it seems to me, you know, no matter what state you're in, you know, this is not self-defense. So I just wanted to, you know, get some feedback from the panel on how they think the stand your ground law applies in this case.
I think you did the best job possible. And I'm going to be brief, and I think we all should, because it's getting close to 9 o'clock, and I think we're going to ask questions. One, I was going to disagree with you, but I agree with you. So I agree that he was, you know, the stand your ground issue, as I keep screaming, all the side fraying of the rug on the side removes us from the most obvious. He has to be charged for what you stated. I have a different perspective. I don't think this is a stand your ground state. It's pretty clear, you know, in your home or personal property in terms of coming out to protect that is the nature. Doesn't mean the dynamics can't be as catastrophic or as dangerous, but it's a little bit different. But the main point, I agree with you. This has nothing to do with the substance of the argument. It is clear that this person was denied his right, his liberty to walk through a community safely without deadly force being applied to him and being murdered. That's that simple.
Yes, tell us your name and your question.
Johnny Patterson, I have three comments, and I'll be very brief. One, I think that we need to not change the clothing, but change the consciousness around what happened with Trayvon. Two, we need to change the public policy standpoint, and I would like to direct this question to you, both of you, Senator Williams and Councilman Johnson. What will you guys do from a policy standpoint to influence your counterparts in the state legislature in Florida and in the city council in Stanford? And also,
in terms of what? Influencing?
Influence them in terms of changing their legislative policy on stand your ground, and also influencing them on arresting, Zimmerman. Last point would be, you know, you said join organizations, but there are a bunch of organizations out here that are worthy of joining, but leadership in those organizations turn people off from joining them.
Hmm. I wonder if you could just, I'm sorry, I can't let you get away with that. Just clarifying what you mean by that.
Without naming names.
Oh, come on. No, just kidding. Just kidding.
Well, without naming names of leadership and organizations.
Initials, no, just kidding.
without naming names of leadership of organizations, I was a part of an organization that the leadership didn't like the movement that I was creating and the way that I was going about doing things, rallying the youth, and they saw me as a threat. So I was ousted out of that organization. And I'll say it, the NAACP.
Okay.
I'm president of the State Youth and College Division.
So don't leave.
Initials.
You threw a ball, you got to carry it back, bro. So two parts. On the influencing the councilman to speak for himself. I don't have any desire to influence the legislature in Florida. Or the council people for. I have the desire to make sure that Pennsylvania doesn't become a state that has a similar law. I also have the desire to express my opinion about what goes on in Florida through mechanisms like this, that hopefully out of this, some people will, obviously the news will cover it, there's a perspective, but in addition to that, specific tools will be in place. And that is, if you don't want to be a part of an organization that's going to write a check into, you know, defense funds or prosecutorial resources, then you should be writing the Justice Department as a citizen. I'm not sure that we do that. I know other people do, but we should. Inquiring as the status and the process going forward. So from where I sit, this is part of my work to get my influence heard there. With regard to organizations, I'm not like you. I sit in the legislature where some people like me, some people don't like me. I sit in the city politically where some people like me and some people don't like me. I get accused every day of stuff I never did, never thought of doing. But guess what? I'm not leaving.
That's right.
Okay? So somebody shouldn't run you out of an organization. What you do is you take over the organization. When I first got involved in politics, my father was involved in politics for years. The way he got involved in politics is because the people in charge of politics didn't want him to be involved in politics. Matter of fact, they offered him a judgeship. He turned it down. Got fired from his law firm. And then went out and politically organized and brought more people of like mind to the political process. So then now you can sit in front of all these black people who claim that, you know, they got there because they're smart. You, if you don't agree with it, this is birthing you. I came here tonight not because I thought it was a great idea. I came here because these other folks who have these organizations with creative terms, Mic Check, which I was like, what the heck is Mic Check? Color Curve. And I came in, you all look splendid. I you know, be honest with you, I thought I might come in here, y'all have your hoodies on, the afros, the pics in the back pocket. Y'all really like splendidly dressed for the occasion. It is your moment. Don't ask permission. I mean, I was chuckling when someone was talking about revolution. Ain't no revolution going on here. It's conversation. I've been a part of revolutions. Revolutions happen on all the inconvenient moments. When you sacrifice time, when you sacrifice money, when you sacrifice, sometimes unfortunately sacrifice their lives.
Right.
Okay? This is a comfortable disagreement. That's a comfortable disagreement. You don't leave an organization. You take it over. And I'm not here speaking for or against the leadership. I'm just being honest. Your generation, stop asking permission. Stop waiting. Just take over.
Beautiful.
Thank you.
Take that to heart, my man. All right, our final comment question. What's your name?
Todd Harrison. I'll make it very brief.
Okay.
Todd Harrison, Vice President, Concerned Black Men, Northwest Section. Football coach for the Overbrook Monarchs, Section. Ran a softball league in South Philly with adult South Philly section. So I see youth all the time, interface with them, work with them every day, all day. This, I heard a lot of people talking about the police. Zimmerman wasn't a cop.
Right.
This dude, he was just a regular guy walking the street that did not value African-American life, a young African-American life. And that is okay, it seems like. So I don't want to get off the subject of police stopping people and how many pet stops and all of that stuff. This guy just did not value a young African-American life. And there's so many guys walking around Philadelphia, Florida, Connecticut, New York, everywhere that do not value our African-American young men.
So I think we need to really focus on that.
Mm.
You know, I mean, all of this conversation about the police, I support our police. They have a tough job out here. You know, they don't have to just worry about young African Americans. They got to worry about rapists, murderers, people robbing, all of that stuff. I support our cops. We need to focus on these people that do not value our African American youth.
Right,
and that is a major issue there.
All right, gotcha. Thank you very much. And our final person, tell us your name and your comment.
I'm Chloe Ballard, and I just have one comment. Violence in Philadelphia, but what we haven't talked about is gun control in America.
Mm-hmm.
It's very easy to get a gun. Basically, that's...
Can everybody hear her?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, speak up.
It's very easy to get a gun in America. And this is why we have people like Zimmerman killing Trayvon. This is why we have black-on-black crime. And basically, I want to know, what are we going to do? It's ridiculous.
It's challenging, especially in Pennsylvania.
Get a gun in America.
I think State Senator Anthony Hardy Williams could speak very much about how hard it is to get that conversation going. Mm-hmm. And can you add it too, for that matter?
I'm turning the privilege over to State Representative Louise Bishop to talk about gun control in Pennsylvania, because she shares the House with an interesting personality, Mr. Terzai.
And getting gun control in the House of Representatives is like being in charge. It's like being the majority, and we are the minority. We get voted down if we go to the bathroom. We have a large number in the majority who is for guns everywhere. But I want to speak perhaps on the spiritual side rather than on the law. I grew up in the South until I was like 13, 14 years old. Every man in the house had a gun. They had a rack, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. They used them for what they were created for, to hunt and to kill animals. We knew and growing up that we were not supposed to touch those guns. So I don't know if gun control is what we need, or if we don't need to get rid of the anger and the arguments and the fighting and the attitude that makes us feel that we have to have a gun to shoot someone. Guns kill, so they say, but I believe people do. People kill. And when we erase the need to have a gun, then of course people can live together. It's anger, it is dislike, it is wanting to hurt someone, and if we don't have a gun, we do it with our hands. Everyone that dies in a awesome murder does not die at the bullet of a gun. There's guns, there's knives, there's weapons, there are hands. We have to find a way to live together again in peace and in harmony. And when we reach that point, these conversations that we're having won't even be necessary. We have to start coming together ourselves, and we have to start being satisfied with ourselves. We have to start loving ourselves. And when we love ourselves, we can love our family, we can love our neighbor, we can love no matter what color you are. When we get in the point where we love ourselves, we don't care about color. It becomes, and race, it becomes insignificant. And we place too much emphasis on guns. We place too much emphasis on violence, and we've got to start placing it, I think, on ourselves. Mm-hmm. Getting along with ourselves means that we can get along with each other. Thank you.
Nothing of these always brings it home. Kenyatta, last word.
Yeah, just one last thing. I think in the context of this, of our conversation, the reason why so much of the conversation was directed toward the police is because they gave Zimmerman a free pass. That's where the focus came from as it relates to the role. If the police would have arrested him and actually went by procedure, held him, gave him a breathalyzer, checked him for drugs, like really went about doing it if the shoe was on the other foot, then they wouldn't even, the police wouldn't even be a part of the conversation. As African Americans in particular, we shouldn't have to wait for other people to value us. They're not going to value us until we start valuing one another. That's always how it's going to be. Until more men step up and start protecting our neighborhood, protecting our children, protecting our women, then the respect level toward African Americans won't change until we do that as a race. So I never look outside of my race and expect other individuals to uplift us and do certain things, because the reality is, the frank part of this conversation, we have to do for self first and foremost. What I did see in this movement that I am proud of, that I did pay close attention to, is when you look at the different movements across the United States, and I saw one in Baltimore, for some particular reason in this Trayvon Martin case, because it was such an injustice, it did bring people of all walks of life together. I didn't just see African Americans marching. I saw young Latino young men down at Love Park the other day, young Caucasians. One young Caucasian had a sign with a hoodie on and said, "I'm Trayvon Martin." Obviously he isn't, right? But for the simple fact that he stepped out on the plate, stepped up and said, "Listen, I want to be a part of this movement," exemplifies what can really take place as we move forward. When you talk about race relations, now this is a totally different generation than individuals who grew up in the 60s who had all different races working together. It is something significant to pay attention to. So, my last comment.
All right. Dr. Cavallis?
On the issue of gun control, people love to talk about gun control and the fact of the matter is there are so many guns already that if Jesus Christ came down from heaven and stopped making them in every part of the United States, we'd still have a lot of guns and a lot of violence. So gun control in many ways, it's not going to change here in Pennsylvania. These heroic legislators can tell you it's not going to change anytime soon. And even if they could, we'd still have a lot of guns. So I hear in leadership, and this will involve the community, that we need to take the energy and really attack the culture and context of violence, which, as Ms. Williams was just talking about so eloquently, where you make the fact that our young people take guns to resolve the most stupid and idiotic of conflicts, we need to suffocate that. As a response, we need to make it is as inhospitable and as impossible to imagine as a Christmas tree growing in the Mojave Desert.
All right, that's all. We're going to leave it at that. And I just want to have us all thank our panel members today for their eloquence. And yes, it's okay to stand up and give them a standing ovation because, yeah, they were awesome. And I am hoping that through the words that they have expressed, that each and every one of you will take something away from this and take an action of some sort, whether it's getting involved in an organization, getting in touch with any of these panel members, following up within your own group of people, becoming leaders, asking to be mentored, passing on the method, the message. We want you to take this as an opportunity to call to action. Want to thank thecolorcurve.com and MicCheck12 for helping to make this thing happen. State Senator Anthony Hardy Williams certainly as well. And thanks to all of you for coming out here on a Saturday night, because clearly you care and you're the ones that are going to make the change in this world. Thank you so much for being with us today, and I'm going to let you all come take over.
Again, thank you everyone for coming out. I just wanted to mention that this whole discussion was streaming live on I Am Not a Rapper, I Spit.com. Eric Blair and Rashad Lambert of I Am Not a Rapper, I Spit.com are here, and this will be on Podcast Wednesdays. You can go to our website, MikeCheck12.com, for more information about that. Again, thank you everybody for coming out. Thank you to Senator Williams for helping organize this. Thank you to State Representative Louise Bishop. Thank you so much for all of our panelists. I just want to thank you all, and I want to reinforce what Lorraine said. Please do something. I heard a lot of everybody asking questions of the panelists. What are you guys going to do? What are you guys going to do? But I just want everybody to realize that you can do something. Everybody in this room can do something. You want to get Zimmerman arrested? You can get Zimmerman arrested. Put the pressure on the people that are in power to get him arrested. So this can't happen again. I want to give a round of applause for our moderator, Lorraine Moore. Please, you did a wonderful job. Again, thank you. MikeCheck12.com. Okay.
Again, I just want to say thank you, and just remember that nothing changes until we change, because we're talking about a young African-American male who was a teenager who was murdered in a southern state. We're talking about somebody that made a decision for this young black man and thought he was up to no good, and he was murdered. And we're talking about a time where our president came out of Columbia University. We're talking about a time where our economy was on the rise. We're talking about a time where there was racism, there was bigotry, there was hardship, but it wasn't that bad. And African Americans were outraged. And I'm not talking about Trayvon Martin. I'm talking about Emmett Till. Because Emmett Till in 1955 was a black teenage boy murdered in the South. Our president was Dwight Eisenhower, who came out of Columbia University. History has repeated itself. The good news was Emmett Till's murder sparked the Civil Rights Movement, which is a movement that I'm grateful for as an African-American male today. But what will it do now in 2012? In the age of information, blogs, technology, basketball wives, and iPads, will there be a movement, or will this be another Amadou Diallo, or will it be another Janus 6? I encourage you to do something. Not all of us are going to be Martin Luther King. Not all of us are going to be Malcolm X or Bethune Cookman, but we can just do our part. If we would just volunteer, if we would just mentor that young kid that doesn't have a way, doesn't see the way, if we could just go to our churches or our places of worship, if we could be responsible parents and responsible human beings, we can make a change. Just remember, nothing changes until we change. Thank you very much.